You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, February 9th, 2015. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the three-time award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live, steps from the industrial-ravaged Gowanus Canal in downtown Brooklyn.
In the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA.
Oh, that's how it goes.
Yes, sir. Still working it out. On today's program, Rafia Zakaria, journalist, commentator, analyst, author of the brilliant new book, The Upstairs Wife, An Intimate Portrait of Pakistan. We're going to be talking about Islam, feminism, drones, her life, all of our lives. Going to be a great interview. Also, because you're loyal listeners of this show, you already know that HSBC basically functions as couriers for global drug and terrorist money. Well, there's even more information on that, and some senators would like to know why there's no criminal repercussions for being a criminal organization. I'm going to talk to you about that. Also, a revolution you don't know anything about that's happening in Syria, and Eric Bolling, even by his standards, rose to the occasion with something so stupid that we actually have to talk about it. Plus,
oh, Eric Bolling's not the only one saying something stupid.
Oh, Matt, yeah, go ahead.
Utah lawmaker Representative Brian Green is really worried that some people might find themselves getting into some sort of legal trouble if you, let's just hold off on it till we get to the story, till we get to the details, because it's really, really something. Also, Fox News takes a look at that Rand Paul CNBC interview that happened that everyone was talking about last week.
Right.
And they find some very interesting things that they took something different out of that interview than, let's say, everybody else did.
Than every other sentient human being. Dean Smith, the great University of North Carolina basketball coach, passed away. I think he was 81. Just legendary coach. And if you're any type of a fan of basketball, which I am, rest in peace. Is there anything else we should mention up top, Matt?
Oh, yes. There. You know what? Maybe I'll talk about it a little bit later, too. But there's something going on, something crazy going on in Alabama with the
marriage equality.
Yes. Yeah. You know what? I want to print something and talk a little bit more about it later because it's a bit more important than just the up top mention.
Right.
But apparently, though, right. Same sex marriage is supposed to be legal starting today in Alabama.
Yeah.
But the Chief Justice, the Alabama Chief Justice, is telling probate judges that they can refuse this.
Oh, okay. Right. As the Supreme Court weighed in? Well, I guess we'll get to that. But obviously,
yes,
that's an important story. So
yes,
he'll be covering that as the show goes on. Okay, folks, thank you so much for listening. This is obviously a Matt and Mike M&M day here on The Majority Report. We'll be right back with Rafia Zakaria. Oh, I'm sorry. I should have.
There we go.
Ready? We will be right back.
Eternal fire, dirty Babylon, you will go get bruised. Me, I want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. Me, I want them bruised. Pack up and go. Me, I beg you, move. I beg you, pack up and go.
Me said the movement alive. Marcus said fi organize and centralize. Rasta fi own banks and enterprise. So me nah stop chanting my soul into Zion. Princes of fire, Babylon me tell ya your time just expire. What kind of wickedness me a your transpire? And no gasoline and a tire. Eternal fire. In dirty Babylon you walk a get bruised. Me a want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. We are want them. I beg your papa, burn one. I tell you, I tell your papa, burn one. But them are going to be and salvation. Better them give me a key and garlic. Pass me the map and a compass on ya. Make me show them say salt fish no come from on ya. The fish they come a far way. They bring him all the way from Norway. Hey, I could rest of them a try for tricker. That can be me national dish a eternal fire. And dirty Babylon you a go get bruised. Me a want them fire. I said they just can't win, you going lose. Can he kill a want them. I beg your back up and go. Me a tell you, quick, back up and go. Oh, tell me why. Every time we hear about Africa, our shackles and chains. Tell me why. You try to corrupt the little Rastaman brain. And if you tell the youth them say Africa exists long before the middle passage. Me come to tell you get a youth them for white because Babylon a brainwash the masses a fire. And dirty Babylon you will go get you.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
I am Michael Brooks. I was just inspired by Matt's response to that new Chronix track.
It was rocking out, man.
Yeah, it was great.
Reggae-ing out.
It was beautiful to see that. Joining us now is author, journalist, commentator, and author of the really excellent new book, The Upstairs Wife, An Intimate History of Pakistan, Rafia Zakaria. Rafia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So, Rafia, start by situating this book. We've talked. I've had you on this program and actually a program I used to do for Aslan Media before, and you're someone who just really does, in my view, a kind of singular job of teasing apart a lot of the intricacies and a lot of the subtleties of a lot of things that sort of get spoken about in really sloppy generalizations, basically. Islam, feminism, foreign policy, balancing all of these different elements. And you are sort of giving the country of Pakistan that treatment really through telling your own story in a way. So situate this book for us. Explain the time that you came of age in Pakistan and how this this story, this narrative holds a frame for everything else that we're trying to understand about this country. And all of the issues that it represents.
Well, thank you so much, Michael. As you know, as you pointed out, I've been a columnist for Dawn, which is Pakistan's largest newspaper, for several years now. And every week, I focus on stories facing Pakistani women and their perspectives on, as the world knows, the growing extremism in Pakistan, the crackdown on women in public space. So, in keeping with that, this book is essentially my attempt to reclaim the story of Pakistan for its women. So it's the story of Karachi, which is the city where I was born and raised, and which is now probably, I think, the biggest Muslim city in the world at 19 million, and tell it through the stories of both women in my family that I knew and love, and then also the women in politics, whether it's Benazir Bhutto, who was a fixture in the political life of the country, and also lesser known women like Shahida Parveen, who was one of the women who was sentenced to be stoned to death under the Hudud ordinances. So the book essentially weaves together all of these stories to present to people the emotional landscape of the country. And, you know, as you well know, in probably covering Pakistan for your show, this is a dimension of Pakistan that is very much left out of the general narrative. You know, it's a security, terror, nukes-dominated story. And this book is my attempt to dislodge that perception.
Yeah, and I would add to that, it's a security, nukes, terror presentation, and then the extent to which women's issues are brought up, and even that phrase, women's issues, we could probably find a way to put that a lot better. But barring that for now, even the way those issues of the human rights of women are brought up, it's usually in the context of sort of an umbrella to justify really problematic policies connected with security and terrorism. So that's another way in which we have to be really conscious about that rhetoric in the West, and that's something you point out very well and very frequently. Going back for a moment, you mentioned the Hudud ordinances. I want you to explain what those are, and then we'll build out from a portrait of someone in your family that sort of exemplifies this. And then I think it's important for us to get to the personality and the legacy of Benazir Bhutto, because everything that we're talking about is really sort of exemplified in her in a certain way for good and for ill. But let's start with the Hudud ordinances and move from there.
Well, the Hudud ordinances were passed in 1979 by then military dictator General Zia-ul-Haq. And essentially, they were an attempt by the Pakistani state to control intimate life, because they were laws that would prosecute and that do prosecute adultery and fornication, and that left particularly women in a very vulnerable position, because if they faced an accusation of zina, or which is adultery or fornication, they could be, be flogged and imprisoned. And a lot of Pakistani women are in prison or have been imprisoned under that. But the most pernicious aspect of it is, of course, that once these laws were passed, the consequence was that if a woman in Pakistan was raped and she chose to file a case or charges against her rapist, she would have to produce 4 adult male witnesses to the act. And if she wasn't able to do that, she was liable for an adultery or a fornication prosecution. So the rape survivor would be, even under existing Pakistani law, prosecuted because just the fact that she was alleging rape was then considered a confession of having had sex outside a marital relationship. So, the way I bring those threads together, the central story of the book is about my aunt. And she did not run into the Hudud or Zina laws, but she did run into the fact that she couldn't bear children, and so her husband decided to take a second wife. And what I tease out is essentially the collective anguish of these laws, whether they're laws restricting women's autonomy in marriage or laws restricting women's sexual autonomy. They impose severe constraints on women's lives. But at the same time, the sort of irony and contradiction of all of it is that even while we've had women in leadership, we haven't been able to change those laws in Pakistan. So unraveling the complexity of that, of the fact that even when Benazir Bhutto, who I described as the freest woman I knew growing up in Pakistan, and this would be true for a lot of girls like me who are growing up in Pakistan, I wanted very much for her to take a stand against these constraints, whether it was against arranged marriage or marriage in general or the fact that these laws existed on the books even when our prime minister was a woman. And that's what the journey I sort of take readers through, is understanding how those complexities are interwoven into the Pakistani context and how it's crucial to understand them if we're going to try to understand the challenges that Pakistani women or Muslim women face today.
Absolutely. And you do a really, really good job of that. I want to get more to Benazir Bhutto and those complexities. But briefly, I want to ask, when we talk about specifically Zelhuk and the Hudud laws, just sort of tracing different histories of different versions of Sharia as an example. Sharia is a term that gets thrown around by a lot of people, whether obviously, you know, there's the sort of extreme of, you know, conspiracy theorists somewhere saying, oh my God, you know, like Sharia is going to get implemented or something. But even people who might kind of pass off as more quote unquote sophisticated commentators, you know, they'll wave around polls about, well, you know, this many British Muslims think, you know, Sharia, you know, is what they want. And that's a big problem. That's a big threat. You know, obviously, Sharia encompasses many different things, many different traditions, some of which are definitely very problematic. And I guess, but some of which also might implicate, as an example, a perception that Islamic finance is more just or less corrupt. And that might be a version that people are responding to as just one example. But specifically in Pakistan and the laws that Zelhuk implemented, would you say that those were out of keeping with, for lack of a better word, kind of Pakistani Islam or the Islam that was more prevalent in South Asia and maybe potentially more having to do with his alliance with Saudi Arabia and kind of importing a particular brand that's much harsher, specifically Saudi? Or was it a more kind of organic expression or all of the above?
Well, I mean, you know, it's that is precisely the question that underlies the book. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's only Westerners that are confused about what Sharia means and how, you know, how law as Islamic law as a single entity can be implemented, whether it's in legislation or it's in personal life. And what I try to do in the book is to take readers into a marriage and into personal life and see how, you know, these very literal interpretation of the Quran, which says you can take more than one wife and that you have to do perfect justice between those wives. So I take them into this relationship so that they can see how the enactment of this perfect justice within a marriage, amounts to a tremendous amount of emotional violence and ruthlessness. Because I think those dimensions of rules, whether it's Sharia or any other law, rarely get explored. But you know, those questions are central to Pakistan right now. I mean, the reason why Pakistan is so mired in conflict is because this question of what Sharia really is, or how you can implement Sharia, whether it's in sexual relationships, you know, with the Zina and Hudud Ordinance, or whether it's in marital relationships with the permission for polygamy, is a very complex question, and people have different answers to it. The point of presenting this relationship is so readers can evaluate that for themselves, whether they're Pakistani or they're American, is that, you know, this disjunct between what is imagined to be a pure or just or perfectly Muslim society and then the realities of people's lives and their emotions are often in contradiction. And so the vision of the world that we have is one that has to be mediated by empathy and by compassion and by sort of understanding those dimensions of marriage as well. That at least is, you know, I've tried very hard to interweave the political context with the personal one, because ultimately I think to understand these questions or to understand the conundrums Pakistanis face, you have to put yourself in the shoes of someone who is Pakistani. And, you know, I think that's what I'm trying to do with Upstairs Wife.
That's definitely what you're doing in my view. And I think, yes, the role of empathy in your work allows you to both, on one hand, actually point to a much more kind of rigorous look at what are the systemic and institutional factors that drive these things we're trying to figure out, whether it's, you know, terrorism or, you know, security arrangements or arms control, all of those issues that get emphasized a lot. But what's the actual context that are driving it? And then on the other hand, through a much more authentic engagement with actual human beings, their narratives, their lived experiences, you're able to get to a much, much bigger and more grounded way of looking at what is, you know, really driving the political landscape and the emotional landscape. And that's, you know, again, that's one of the things I find really important about your work. Now, going to Benazir Bhutto, it's really interesting. Yes, you describe her as the freest woman that you sort of knew and saw growing up. And I think Benazir Bhutto, you know, there's the reality of her record, which I want you to get to, you know, good and bad. Then there's also what she represented in Pakistan. I think she represented something very clear in the West, which is in the sense that until, you know, there was a certain point where her sort of image soured, and there was a lot of reports in places like the New York Times on, you know, particularly her husband actually and corruption and this and that. But there was also a certain impulse within the certainly the American, but more broadly Western foreign policy establishment, that just her as this kind of charismatic individual could bypass all of the other variables in Pakistan. Like, oh, well, we got Benazir there, and she's, you know, she went to Harvard. She went to, I think she also went to Oxford. She's very sophisticated. She knows how to speak, you know, the language of Davos. And she's the prime minister, so we're good to go. And of course, that wasn't the case. And in some ways, those policies actually aided areas where her governance was really problematic. But, you know, I just want your take on her personality and her presence and that legacy, because that does seem like it just – it embodies so many of the things you're talking about.
Indeed. I mean, the book opens on the day of Benazir's assassination, and this question that I was struggling with on whether this represents an end moment of some sort for Pakistani women. Mm-hmm. Her figure was a very strong one in my life growing up, not because, I didn't know her personally and never met her, but she was everywhere on TV, in the newspapers, now, very obviously a very, very public and controversial figure in Pakistan. But the moment that I describe in the book, in the exploration of it, is that the one that most resounded with me was watching Benazir Bhutto get married, because that was broadcast live on Pakistani TV in Karachi when I was a young girl growing up. And here was this woman who I expected, because she was defying so many other norms, to kind of defy that traditional role of wife and mother. So, you know, here I was being raised to also ascribe and fit into those roles. So I wanted very much for her to be an example that I could say, okay, well, you know, she's not living the typical life of marriage and kids. So if you have that expectation, I mean, and, you know, I wasn't quite so conscious of it, obviously, as a young girl, but that's what I wanted from her. You know, I wanted to be able to say to my mother or my grandmother that, you know, not every Pakistani woman just gets married and has kids. So when you have that as a backdrop and you see this visual of Benazir Bhutto getting married, and she's marrying this, you know, man from a feudal family, right, and it's an arranged marriage and all of that. In some ways, in that childish sense, your heart sinks, because here is, like you said, you know, I call her the freest woman we knew, also ascribing to a gender role that everybody else has to ascribe to. And in a way that represented kind of, you know, there's no exit here. Mm. And of course, later on, you know, I do unravel her politics as well and the compromises she had to make. And there are parallels between that and those sort of political compromises and perhaps, you know, the compromises that women have to make in marriages and in intimate relationships, and the ones that my aunt had to make.
The parallels are really, they're very, very revealing. But before we finish up this conversation, I was just hoping we could touch on something else that's happening in Pakistan right now, which is in response. And again, it's a very, very interesting thing, the way this plays out in the West, in response to the terrorist attack on the children at the military school several months ago, which really, you know, was a sort of, at least in the way it was presented, and it obviously literally was, it's just a sort of particularly horrifying event. And the Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif announced this sort of new strong push against the Pakistani Taliban and implementing military courts and all of this other sort of new moves against terrorism. And now in Pakistan, there is a civil society movement which is moving, it seems. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like there's two components of it, which is that there's a question around things like, is the answer to dealing with the terrorist crisis by empowering some of the elements in Pakistani politics and power structure that help facilitate these groups growing to begin with? And secondly, there's specific groups in Pakistan that are also terrorist groups that are explicitly not being targeted by the Sharif government. And I'm just wondering if you could just touch on this and give us a sense of what's going on.
Well, you're absolutely right. Is that, you know, since the Peshawar attack, the civil society in Pakistan has tried very hard to mobilize against some of these extremist groups that they perceive and correctly perceive as having, getting some shelter from government authorities. So whether it's the current protest that's asking, you know, for the arrest of the leader of ASWJ, or a few weeks earlier, there was another similar protest in which the head of the Red Mosque in Islamabad refused to condemn the killers of the Peshawar attack. Right. And he went, he publicly refused to do that. And that's kind of was the genesis of this civil society movement. And they've been pressing for his arrest and saying that, you know, the government can't just say we're cracking down on terror. We want to see that. They did ultimately get charges filed against him, against this other cleric in that case, but they have, you know, he's still to be arrested. The police has not arrested him. And so it's a similar situation right now with this ongoing protest, is because people are saying, you know, you say you condemn terrorism, then why are these people going free? We've gone and established military courts, and the government says again and again that it's a black and white issue. They're not going to pick and choose the terrorists. They're going to prosecute. So we're going to hold the government accountable to that. And I'm really glad that you're bringing out this story, because it's these stories, that get completely sidelined. No one wants to talk about when Pakistanis, ordinary Pakistanis, are out there in the protest, saying, you know, out on the streets in a very dangerous country right now, and asking for this. I mean, in the last protest, I know of a woman, she was the only woman who participated in the protest, and she, you know, was beaten up by some of the thugs from this, who are supporters of extremism. And despite that, she was out there. So we've got these stories of heroism and bravery in Pakistan. And, you know, but it's an uphill battle to get people to engage with them and to get a deeper understanding of the country beyond, you know, are the nukes safe for, the most dangerous place in the world sort of narrative.
Right. And also it's the most interesting story, because you're having this massive group of people that are taking on the government as well as genuinely really dangerous terrorist organizations. And this conversation that we either got to back some mediocre autocrat, or just so we can have, you know, passage to run drone attacks that are going to kill a lot of civilians, or, you know, the other option is it's just run by terrorists, is is both incredibly problematic. It's also dull and stupid. And I just would like to mention Gibran Nasir, who was involved in these organizings, and I was actually in touch with him a little over a week ago, shortly before he was arrested. And you know, Rafia, I think the work you do is essential to what you're talking about. So I just really, really appreciate your time. The book is The Upstairs Wife: An Intimate History of Pakistan, and you can let the hotel know that they can run their fire drill now.
Yes, I will. And, you know, just a shout out to independent bookstores. They are promoting the book. It's the February pick of the month for, you know, the Indie Best Selection. And
great.
So if anyone wants it, they should go out to the independent bookstore in their neighborhood and get The Upstairs Wife from there. So,
and there is a link to it on our website if you don't want to support independent bookstores and buy it through Amazon, but it is through our link, so you will give us a slight kickback. But yes, buy independent book through independent bookstores. It's a great book. Rafia, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Monday, February 9th, 2015, that's today, Alabama was set to become the 37th state with marriage equality. However, certain courthouses will not be issuing same-sex marriage licenses because Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore, a conservative chief justice, sent a letter to probate judges ordering them to refuse to issue the same-sex marriage licenses, saying that the judges weren't bound by a federal judge's ruling on January 23rd that the marriage ban was unconstitutional. U.S. District Judge Callie Grenade ruled that state marriage ban was unconstitutional and in a clarification order, said that probate judges had a legal duty under the U.S. Constitution to issue the licenses. Now, for a little background on this Chief Justice Moore, he's long been Alabama's most outspoken critic of gay marriage. He called homosexuality an evil in a 2002 custody ruling and urged judges to reject issuing such licenses in recent days. Wow, this guy certainly doesn't have an agenda. This guy's a chief justice in the Alabama
court. He's a long-term fanatic.
A few probate judges have said they would actually refuse to issue the licenses until they got greater clarity from the courts. Oh, wow. They need greater clarity from the courts. Oh, I could understand that, you know, except for the whole U.S. district judge saying that the marriage ban was unconstitutional. I mean, I don't know what greater clarity you need. How can they clarify that anymore for you? Let me clear this for you guys. Let me make this absolutely clear. It is unconstitutional. I mean, how can they make it any clearer? The Supreme Court has not ruled on the state's request, which is hours to go. This was last night, until the courthouse is open on Monday, which is today now. Attorney General Luther Strange has asked the U.S. Supreme Court to put aside the U.S. District Judge's order, since justices are expected to issue a ruling later this year on whether gay couples have a right to marry nationwide. Can't you same-sex couples just hold off until the Supreme Court decides what 36 other states have already decided?
Some counties are still going forward in Alabama.
Yes, counties are issuing the licenses. Others are sadly not, even though actually, legally, it is absolutely legal right now. There is marriage equality in Alabama. There is no stay. There's no order saying to hold off.
That's right.
They are legal. The counties and the judges who are choosing not to issue these licenses are breaking the law and doing so explicitly contrary to the Constitution of the United States of America. Simple as that. But freedom and the Constitution. Oh, wait. not the Constitution in this specific instance, please.
Okay, folks. Straight to the fun half?
Yeah, let's go straight to the fun half.
Okay, guys. As always, become a member of the show. Majority.fm. You know, this is how everything runs.
Just click become a member up top, and you can just do it right there. Less than a cheap bodega / local corner deli / whatever they have by you. I know bodega isn't a general term for many.
7-Eleven, coffee, whatever kind of.
It's cheaper than that.
Even if you buy, well, and certainly it's cheaper than the type of kind of fancy, nice coffee. I assume that a not insubstantial amount of this audience is buying. So, yes, please do that.
You could also support this show by buying all of your junk through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com.
Buy Rafia's book. The link is right on our blog page.
Yes.
Great book.
Or any of our guests.
If you're interested in their book,
buy it through that link. Yeah. You support that author. You support this show. It's a win-win.
Win-win-win.
And then if you do drink coffee, what's better than fair trade coffee? Nothing. That's what's better than fair trade coffee. So you go to justcoffee.coop. That's justcoffee.coop. And you put in a coupon code majority. And you will get 10% off your order. Isn't that incredible? There's also a Majority Report blend there. For all of you new listeners who weren't familiar with that. That's right. You can drink Majority Report inspired coffee blend. Amazing, isn't it?
It's really good. Legit.
Yeah. We're forced to drink it here, whether we like it or not. Nah. We like it.
We are. I mean, it's good. It's good to be forced to drink something.
But one time I drank a Marin blend, and that was almost the end of me.
I remember it ruined my evening. I was so bad. I broke up with a girl after I drank it. I was just in such a bad mood.
Listen.
It literally transmits the spirit of Marin. I all of a sudden just wanted to get a bunch of cats and argue with people.
Is that everyone?
Write an iTunes review.
Oh, yes, the iTunes review. Please. I think at this point, Sam is like super all in with the iTunes reviews. I think that would make him super happy right now.
Yeah,
just
definitely.
Leave us an iTunes review. You know, click the 5-star button and leave a little text. Type out a little review of the show. Give you a review of Sam, the Matt and Mike show, whatever you'd like. And Sam will be very happy. He'll be very pleased.
And not yet, but pretty soon you're going to be able to vote for the podcast awards.
If enough of you nominated us, we will soon find out whether or not we make it through as a nominated podcast in the podcast awards. And when that happens, if that happens, I think it's more of a when that happens.
I agree.
We will let you know when the voting begins.
Okay, everybody, we will see you on the fun half. We got a lot of stories.
We got a lot in the fun half. This is certainly going to be a fun half.
It is going to be both funny and fun.
And informative.
And informative.
Informative. Info.
Info formation-tainment.
Yes, because we are giving you information. This is an infotainment.
The IM is fired on.
646-257-3920. That number is 646-257-3920. You can call into this show. You can debate us if you're a libertarian, a conservative, or anybody. If you have something that you disagree with us about, we love a volume being. Yes, we love debate.
I'm just kidding.
You can also call us and give us your viewpoint of something. Teach us something if you're in Greece and you have a better on the ground of what's going on there. If you're anywhere in the world.
Oh, yeah. You know what? Don't call us to teach us something unless you're in Greece.
Yes. I don't give a crap about wherever else you are.
Yeah, don't call up from friggin' Ohio or California and be like, yeah, there's something to teach you.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, get out of here. Go to Greece and call us.
If you are anywhere, if you're in Alabama right now and you are trying to get your marriage license.
And you're in the middle of a civil rights crisis.
And they
call
turned you down. By all means, we will give you as long as you'd like. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half, the better half of the show. I will now play the music, which I forgot to play.
I was going to say, I thought it was like pregnant pause. Thank you.
watching Apple Pay.